Welcome to the first episode of the Brighton Book Club of 2022. This month we're talking new beginnings. Lisa Edwards, Sussex author of Cheat, Play, Live, joins us to talk about the book that follows the author as she starts again in her 40s and redefines what it traditionally is to be a woman. We talk to Beth Miller about her new book, The Woman Who Came Back to Life, about losing yourself and finding yourself and having the courage to start again. Caitlin Gleeson talks to local author Joe Furness about Hove's Creative Writing Club, a group that meets weekly in Hove to learn from experts and write without distraction. Our book club book, Unsettled Ground by Care Fuller, a writer who started again as an author in her 40s, joins us to talk about her multi-prize shortlisted novel. If you'd like to get in contact with the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at btnbookclub. Enjoy the show. Lisa Edwards' book, Cheat, Play, Live, follows her journey to fearlessness and freedom for a life beyond the one prescribed for women, marriage, babies, a high-flying career. Here is the blurb. On a beach in California, Lisa finds a shell on a rock, its two halves open to the sky. On the outside, it is sea-worn and unremarkable, but on the inside, it gleams like a jewel. She wonders if it is waiting to be found and cherished, like her. The shell is the image she uses to set up an online profile that will end her marriage. It leads her to more beaches around the world, to Kenya, Thailand, Turkey, Egypt, and India, in search of the freedom to choose how she wants to live. On a beach in Goa, she confronts the grief that she has been numbing with alcohol and finds a way to break the lock on a secret she's been keeping inside her since she was a little girl. Lisa, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, Anna. Lovely to be here.
When did you decide to write Cheat, Play, Live?
Oh, well, I guess it's been kind of bubbling under for a while. At various points along my journey, I'm in publishing. So, you know, storytelling is just part of the, you know, day-to-day life, really, but usually handling other people's stories. And I've talked about things that have happened in my life, and jokingly, but not jokingly, a few people have said, oh, you should write that down. I'd read that. And I thought to myself, yeah, maybe there's a story here, but I just didn't quite get there. And then a friend said to me that I should start writing. And I started writing a blog some years ago now, and it was called Because I Can. And it was outlining my life as a sort of free from marriage, newly freed from marriage, woman in her 40s, flying solo, literally and figuratively around the world. And so the blog started to gain ground and I found my writing legs, so to speak. And then it all came to a head. I think it was 2019 where I found myself stepping out of corporate life, going to India and starting a different journey. I did yoga teacher training, but just before that, this story was just fighting to get out, and I just poured it out. I wrote 3,000 words a day during a month in India, and it just all poured out in a very, very raw state, which is not the version you've read in the book now, but it was the first kind of raw director's cut, if you like.
So the title, Lisa, is a play on Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, which is a book that you cite as definitely an inspiration for the book. Why and how did you decide to subvert this? How is Cheat, Play, Live different?
Well, as you'll find reading the book, Eat, Pray, Love did play a pivotal role in my life. I read it just at the point where I was ready to leave a marriage, just like Elizabeth Gilbert, and I couldn't believe how much her story resonated. And I tried to stop myself being a bit of a Gilbert groupie and going to Bali, but I ended up going to Thailand and various other beaches around the world, trying not to be her, but kind of being her. Finding myself on different beaches, encountering different men, different lifestyles, different philosophies. And then when it came to the titling, I'd had this idea about Cheat, Play, Live, about how my version was kind of the slightly more gritty version. When I read Eat, Pray, Love, it kind of held back. It was a bit too sanitized for me because I knew what really happened on beaches around the world, you know, and it wasn't pretty. I didn't hold back from various encounters, as readers will find out, but I felt she did, and I wanted her to go further. So when people ask me about the book, I often say it's Eat, Pray, Love, the X-rated version. It just goes further and spills the beans on, you know, what happened after the lights went down, kind of thing.
Can you read us some, please, Lisa, from the book?
So I'm going to read from a section. My book is split into three parts, Cheat, Play and Live. And within those sections, I've arranged the narrative into what happened at various beaches around the world. It wasn't until I'd read the book, written the book, that I realised much of my story had taken place on beaches. So it's a useful framework. So my first holiday solo after leaving my husband was to Thailand, when I was trying not to be Elizabeth Gilbert and not to go to Bali. I ended up going to Phuket in Thailand. So I'm just going to read about what happened on that first trip. Patong Beach, Phuket, Thailand, August 2010. I watched the little plane on the map on the back of the seat fly its course over Europe, Asia, and then Southeast Asia. I would be flying into Bangkok Airport and then taking a linking flight to Phuket. Where I was going was somewhere real travellers would probably avoid, Patong. But what I needed was a lovely hotel near a bustling town, and that's what I got. I revelled in everything that I take for granted now, the welcome drink of exotic fruit juice, the flowers decorating my bed and the towels sculpted into the shape of animals. It was August and the off season, so they upgraded me to a beachfront room with a balcony overlooking the sea framed by swaying palm trees. It was perfect, or it would have been if I'd been on a romantic holiday for two. One of the first things I did after I left my husband was book a holiday. I'd never been anywhere outside the UK on my own, but suddenly I felt the urge. I called a travel operator, how quaint, and asked them where they could take me for a week or two for my budget. Thailand, they said. It was almost Bali, but crucially not Bali. I was very keen not to be an Eat, Pray, Love groupie. Thailand was where solo travellers went, knowing there would be other solo travellers. It was a well-worn path, and that would give me a foundation to work from. I wanted somewhere that was far enough away that I wouldn't be tempted to fly back if I lost my nerve. A 16-hour flight would do it. I always wanted to go to Thailand, Graham said regretfully as soon as he discovered my plan. He offered to take me to the airport, and I'll never forget the look on his face when he dropped me off. It said, wow, she's really doing this. This time I didn't have to wait for him to finish three cigarettes before going through to departures. He wouldn't be making me cry at the other end for booking something he didn't like or trying to photograph me in a microscopic bikini. This was a holiday for me, and there would be no recourse to anyone else. But oh, the despair. It kicked in on the first evening. I was in a paradise location, complete with Disney levels of butterflies dancing around the gardens between my room and the beach. I was surrounded by romantic couples, and here I was on my own. I drank cocktails at happy hour in a bid to cheer myself up, but I ended up crying into my Thai green curry in the restaurant. The staff didn't know what to do, so they stayed away from me. I cried nonstop for 3 days and barely left my room. I cried for my failed marriage, the time I'd wasted with the wrong man, the time he'd wasted with the wrong woman, and the time I'd wasted with no men. I cried for what I'd done to Graham by cheating on him because he didn't deserve it. I cried for the holiday adventures I'd had with him that I'd never have again, and I cried for the loss of coupledom. I didn't have my hand in anyone's hand, and I was out there alone with no one caring. But someone did care. Friends sent texts to see how I was getting on. I admitted that I felt miserable. I was getting up every morning to go to breakfast and wearing sunglasses because my eyes were so screwed up by all the crying. I pulled on a lovely dress to make myself feel better, a breakfast dress. I've continued with this breakfast dress tradition on holiday ever since. I often look more glamorous in the mornings than I do in the evenings. It's something I like to do for myself when I'm away, and I recommend it. If I dress up at night, people think I'm on the lookout. So I dress up in the mornings instead. Breakfast dress.
It's such a vivid picture of such a specific part of your life, Lisa. And I know that some of this book was fueled by the grief after the loss of your mother. Did you find it cathartic or somehow healing in the process of grieving?
Yes. I mean, I've realised that much of the writing and redrafting of this story is about me coming to terms with that and the huge impact the loss of both my parents actually had on me. I lost my father when I was 10. And as the book recounts, my mother when I was think 32, and it happened before I got married. And I just didn't realise the huge impact they had on my life journey, and that certain things I did, like start to depend on alcohol, which then led to me making bad decisions. It had such a profound effect on everything that happened.
Absolutely. Lisa, you've got a background in the publishing industry. Why did you decide to go alone and found Redwood Tree Publishing House to publish your book?
I'm somebody who likes to move quickly. I often act spontaneously and I go with my gut feeling. And when I first wrote the raw version I mentioned earlier in India, I made the mistake of showing that raw version to a few people, one of whom was going to be my agent for the book. But I now realise that version was just for my eyes only. And I would urge anyone writing a memoir not to show the first version to anyone, because it was filled with everything inside that had to come out, the bitterness, the anger, the blame, things that I thought about everybody. And the new, my journey through the writing of it has expelled all of those things and finally ended up with a version where I take responsibility. So whilst this new draft, which was finished last year, is in much better shape and I could have shown it around, I chose not to show it to anyone. I felt very strongly it was my story to tell, to be in control of creatively, everythingly, and I knew I would have to wait months, years, if ever, to get some sort of deal, and that's not my thing. So I just decided to go for it and publish it on my mother's birthday on August the 14th, and make that moment have some meaning. And I'd been told by a medium who features in the story that I was here to help other people, and I thought my story could help others who were perhaps trapped in unhappy relationships or marriages or jobs, and show them that there were other options. So Redwood Tree Publishing already existed as my company as an editor. I write children's books and I edit children's books and adult books. And I just decided to launch the book under that company name. And it's extraordinarily powerful. Owning your own story, especially, it literally is your own memoir, and putting it out there.
Absolutely, it's very empowering and it is beautifully produced. So Lisa, you are based just outside of Brighton in Worthing, near the sea. What part does being near bodies of water play for you? Because I do know you love the beach, and that really features in your book.
Yes, well, I think I've only just realised how important it is for me to live by the sea. I grew up in North Wales near the coast, although it wasn't a particularly beachy area. I think I need the limitless horizon of sea. I've tried lakes and rivers and it's just not the same as the sea and that limitless horizon. So I was in India when COVID struck and I came back to Worthing because I knew I'd need to be by the sea. It was always the plan anyway, but it just went faster because of COVID. And whilst I was redrafting this book, I walk up and down the seaside in Worthing every single morning. And I realised that's where all my best creative ideas come. I got the idea for framing the story in beaches whilst I was walking. I had so many ideas for ways of improving the text while I was walking, and then I jot them on my phone and then get back to my flat and then quickly type them in, so that I knew I'd covered everything. So I know that everything I could possibly think of has gone into that book.
What's next for you, Lisa? What are you working on?
Well, I started work on book two, which is called Dark Horses. And people may know that there's a white horse that figures, a kind of spirit animal in Cheap Play Live, who was for me an icon of freedom and independence. She walked up and down the beach every day in Goa and no one knew who she belonged to. So for me, she was my icon. Dark Horses is about, you know, not everything is rosy in the garden of Lisa. One of the key themes is menopause and the kind of stormy waters that brings something that I was dealing with in India and back here as well. So Dark Horse is possibly, hopefully, publishing next summer. And I'm launching in a sort of bid to try and help people with various themes I cover in the book. I'm launching a series of guides from January called Because I Can. And the first one is Because You Can, One Woman's Guide to Living Without Alcohol, because one of the key themes of Cheap Play Live is my addiction to alcohol and then my new sobriety. And I really want to sort of pass on the message to people that life is significantly better without alcohol, especially if you're menopausal. So those $1.99 guides launch in January.
And how can we find and follow you and buy a copy of your book?
Oh, well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Redwoods1 on Twitter and Instagram. Redwoods comes from how people say my name, Lisa Redwoods, when they put the R in. And you'll find out the significance of Redwoods, Redwood trees in Cheap Play Live. So that's where you can find me. My blog is becauseicanblog.com. You can follow my story there. I've got a Because You Can Facebook page. And if you follow me on Twitter, there's a link tree to all of the different elements of the book. The link to Amazon where it's sold. You can order my book if you don't want to use Amazon through bookshops because it's with Ingram Spark.
Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa. You may remember our next guest, local author Beth Miller, who came on the show over the summer. Well, Beth has a new book out this month called The Woman Who Came Back to Life. Welcome back, Beth.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for having me again.
It's lovely to have you back. So let's talk about The Woman Who Came Back to Life. What is it about?
It's about a woman called Pearl who's in her early 50s and she lives in France in the middle of a wood with her husband. And at the start of the story, we see that she's sort of quite cut off from life. She and her husband have moved there and they aren't really in contact with anyone from her family. And then the world starts to encroach and Pearl has to kind of deal with coming back into the world. And we find out, you know, obviously a lot of things about her and why she's there in France and what went on with her family as we go through the story.
A common theme in your books is new beginnings, which is interestingly the theme for our show this month. What appeals to you about writing kind of reform and rebirth?
I think it's really interesting that you have spotted that theme because I don't think I do it consciously. I think it just comes out when I'm writing. So it's obviously something that is subconsciously in my mind. I just think it's quite a rich seam to mine for fiction. Thinking about, you know, people get stuck in ruts and then time passes and you don't even notice time passing. And then suddenly you look around and you think, well, how did I get here? And where is my beautiful wife and my lovely car? And thinking about how you can turn your life around from what it was and make changes, I find really interesting and exciting. So I guess that's where it comes from.
Can you read some for us, please, Beth?
So this is just a little bit, this isn't quite the beginning, it's quite near the beginning. So Pearl lives with her husband, Denny, as I said, in the middle of this wood, and they can't even drive up to their house. They have to walk through the wood to get to their house and from town. And Pearl is slightly going through a bit of a crisis at the moment. Things are a bit topsy-turvy, but she has managed to get out of the house after a few days and go into town. And this is just her coming back from town. What happens then? After coffee, I took a whistle-stop tour of the boulangerie, butcher and greengrocer and weighed down with bags, headed back into the wood, feeling, as I so often did on leaving town, that I'd done enough socialising for a month. I was halfway back to the cottage when I heard my phone ring. Heart thudding, because last time my phone rang in the woods, it didn't go so well. I rifled through my bag. But I couldn't find my phone. I turned out all my pockets and still it rang. I went through the carrier bags in case I'd absent-mindedly put it in one and annoyingly dropped a cheese out of its wrapper onto the ground, but it wasn't there. At the exact same moment the ringing stopped, I remembered that I didn't have the phone with me. I'd left it behind with Denny. I sat on the grass verge at the side of the path, surrounded by my strewn belongings, wondering if I was properly losing my mind. Then a man walked past. He didn't acknowledge me. He was in his 40s, his bearded face lined and weather-beaten. He had a leather strap over his shoulder. It took me a moment to say anything because I had never before seen a stranger in the wood and my brain struggled to process his existence. Trespassers were Denny's nightmare. After we moved out here, his first big project was to build a fence around the entire perimeter of the wood. He didn't properly relax until it was finished. The only entry point was a forbidding-looking iron gate, which was plastered with keep-out signs, and almost no one, to my knowledge, had ignored them until now. "Hey," I called, and the man reluctantly stopped. "Yeah?" "Was that your phone ringing?" "Yeah." "But you didn't answer it." "Who the hell are you, my wife?" His words, which should have seemed rude, were actually rather droll in his Parisian accent. "I thought it was my phone. It's the same ringtone." "Wow, we match." I got to my feet. "What are you doing here?" "Excuse me." I reminded myself that I did not like confrontation. What was I doing? Stammering slightly, I said, "These woods are private. Didn't you see the signs?" "Oh, signs are BS. I walk where I like." His humorous face was quite at odds with his words. "Arrache toi, lady. Clear off." "You're the one trespassing, not me." He laughed. "Fine. I was leaving anyway." He turned and went back the way he'd come. As he rounded the bend, I saw that the leather strap over his shoulder was attached to my field glasses. That completely knocked the stuffing out of me, and I sat down again on the verge. The glasses were the last gift Dad gave me before he left us, my 15th birthday present. I remembered my glee on opening them. They were tiny, designed to fit in a pocket, clean and sharp as a magnifying glass. I called them baby binoculars, which Dad found amusing. Not for the first time, I wondered if, in giving me something so precious, he had hoped to soften the blow of his leaving.
Your characters, Beth, are so vivid, and you're such a prolific writer. You write so much. How do you get into their heads and stay in there and not get them all kind of muddled up?
That's so interesting. I don't think I do get them muddled up because I think they're really real to me. I can sort of see them. Once I've spent a bit of time with them in the writing, they are as real an individual to me as my friends. I think once I've got their voice, once I can see and hear how they look and talk, I think I stop getting any, there's no chance then of getting them muddled. I think they just become real to me. I'm always really astonished, amazed and gratified if they seem real to other people, because they're real to me. I guess that other people, one will never know this, of course, but I guess other people see them differently to how I see them, but they do somehow often seem real to other people, which always absolutely astonishes me.
You have been praised for your emotive but ultimately feel good books. Why do we need these, and why do we need them especially now? And what do you say to people who kind of think that uplit or feel good books are worth less than perhaps high literary fiction?
I think it's very interesting what people think is and isn't valuable. And very often things that, I hate to say it, but things that women like, as a, you know, not as a, not, it's not all women and it's not only women, but things that generally are perceived to be liked by women often seem to have a lower cultural value somehow. And I think reasons for that are very complicated, and I don't want to do a TED talk about it now, but I think there's huge value in books that explore emotions, allow us to see emotions that we might feel on the page and see, you know, that it's, you know, other people might feel the same way as us and that we're not alone in the way that we feel. I just saw something on social media yesterday from Kristen Bailey, who writes sort of humorous fiction and uplit. And she was just posting something that someone, a reader had sent her, just saying that her books got this person's mother through, you know, the most difficult year of her life. It was the only thing that made her laugh in a, in, you know, during a very, you know, so many people have had a horribly bleak year. And it was the only, Christian's books were the only thing that made this lady laugh in it, like the whole year. And I, you know, that is a valuable public service right there. And so now, why now more than ever? Well, I just think we're going through rather strange times. And every time we think that there's, like, you know, calmness on the horizon, it all seems to be a bit difficult again. And I think people need, you know, we can wallow in the news and we can, you know, feel terrible about what's going on. But sometimes we just need to think about something else, and maybe get a bit of a perspective on it that, you know, hopefully not everything is bad, even if it's just to read something to distract us. I think that's incredibly valuable. But I would say that, you know, absolutely loads of the so-called like uplit or women's fiction that I've read, I just think is staggeringly well written and interesting. And, you know, you just you feel like it represents the world as you know it in a way that, I mean, I love literary fiction as well. I love pretty much all writing, all fiction and nonfiction as well. But I see different things in all of those. And I think they all valuable in, you know, in different ways and to different people and at different times. So yes, down with snobbery, hurrah.
So before writing, you did a lot of other things. So writing in itself was a new beginning for you. How did you come to it, and how did what you do before dictate in any way your writing career?
Has been a rather winding road to get here. I loved writing at school, like lots of writers, you know, I really loved writing at school. And then I didn't really think about writing fiction for a long time. I did writing in all my jobs. I've had a slightly odd career because my first job was as a university lecturer when I was way too young for it. I feel like I've sometimes had a sort of career in reverse. And it's a bit of a long story how I ended up doing that. I taught psychology for a few years in a university in Wales. And I always managed to, while I was doing that, do lots of writing. I wrote student handouts, which I really liked, and I wrote the student guide to the university. And I always managed to somehow, if ever anyone said, who wants to write a newsletter, I always managed to get to do it. So I obviously liked writing. And then I just did loads of other jobs. I worked in sexual health for a while, working for an HIV charity, and then I taught sexual health education in schools for a while, which was very entertaining. And I ran a young people's advice and counselling service for a bit. And then in my 30s, I can't quite remember how it happened, but I think I saw an evening class advertised at my local college for creative writing. And I thought, you know, I used to really like writing. So I did the evening class and I really loved it. And I just started writing bits and pieces. And then years went by again, and I'm making myself sound like I'm about 100. But anyway, I feel like it's been going on for a long time. And then I finally started working for New Writing South. I think I might have mentioned this last time I spoke to you, which is a writing support agency in Brighton. And I was helping place writers in schools. And I was just very envious of the writers who went into schools. So I wished I was a writer and I could go into schools and do writing with young people. And so I just started work on a novel. And then, a mere few years later, I got a first draft. God, it was all very slow at the beginning. Eventually, the book turned into something more than just sort of, you know, writing in the evenings and on holidays. And I started taking it more seriously and eventually got an agent. But I've always worked while I've been writing as well. I'm not a full-time writer. At the moment, my day job is working for the Royal Literary Fund, where I work in Brighton University. I help students with their essay writing, which is absolutely brilliant. I love working alongside writing because it gives me other things to think about other than the writing. I don't just stay in my own head, which is probably not super productive. I go out and sort of meet other people and hear other people's things and stories. So I have something to think about. That was a long answer, sorry.
No, it's great. So what are you working on next, Beth?
Okay, so I'm at the very early stages of the next book, and all I can really say about it is that it's a real passion project. It's something that I've been thinking about writing for a long time, and it's about the circus.
How exciting. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. How can we buy a copy of your book, find and follow you?
The book is in the usual places. It's ebook and paperback and audio, and just, yes, all the usual places. And I've got a website, which is bethmiller.co.uk, that pretty much links to all my social media. So that's probably the easiest thing to find me.
Thank you very much.
Today I'm chatting to Jo Furness, author, Brighton resident and creator of Hove Writers Club. Thank you for joining me today, Jo.
Hi, Caitlin.
So tell me what Hove Writers is all about and why you started the group.
Yeah, well, I started the group because actually I moved to Hove and I wanted to, you know, join a group. For years, I've always been a part of a writer's group, and being in a new place, you know, I needed to find one. And I think it was around about this time last year, we were probably in one of the many lockdowns, and I was spent a lot of time walking up and down the seafront, and I would see all the exercise groups, and weirdly I thought to myself, that's kind of what I want, but for writing. I really liked, sort of, you know, how the exercise groups will come together, like they're doing yoga or they're doing high intensity training or whatever, and they're kind of encouraging each other and sort of, you know, driving each other to work a little bit harder, and sort of helping each other along. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of what I want, except with a group of writers. So I sort of thought about it, and I thought what I would want is to meet quite regularly, and to sort of share our knowledge and to actually write alongside other people and kind of hold each other accountable. And yeah, like I say, just kind of drive each other on, and instead of, you know, sort of building muscles, we would kind of write our words, you know. And I had no idea really whether anybody else would want to work in this way, but I kind of floated the idea, and really quickly actually got a great response, and so we've been going now for, well, a little bit over 6 months.
Fantastic. And so tell me a bit about the format of the sessions and what you cover in each session.
Yeah, sure. So we meet, well, every week, most weeks, on a Monday evening. And we we get together from sort of 7 until 10 o'clock. And the first part is a power hour. So from 7 to 8 p.m., I try to sort of, like, you know, really give some content to the meeting. So we might have like a guest author come along and we'll do a Q&A, or I might run sort of a bit of a workshop on some kind of technical skill. I have tutored a fair bit in the past as well. So it's quite nice to sort of, you know, bring some of those elements into it. Or I might run a kind of a writing exercise just to get some inspiration. So that first hour, hopefully we can kind of, you know, yeah, we can really sort of build our skills. And I do ask the group as well to share some of their skills. So it's not, you know, it's not just me. And so in the past, quite a few of the other members of the group have taken sessions, and they've maybe sort of, you know, taught something that they've picked up in a previous course, or they've kind of share some tips about, I don't know, applying for competitions and things like that. And then from 8 till 10, that is the that's our time to write. So then I encourage everyone just to kind of break out. Everyone tends to bring their laptops or whatever they need to write, and we all just find a little quiet spot and we co-write. And that's probably the part of it that I wasn't really sure if other people would find that as appealing as I do. It's something I've done in the past, but actually I think that's what most people get out of the regular meetings, is that sort of dedicated time when they know they're going to get 2 hours uninterrupted to themselves, just to work on their whatever it is they're writing, their novel, their short story, their screenplay. And people in general seem to really love that. They know that across the week, they're going to get that time to themselves. And I think it's particularly nice that it's a Monday night, because I think if you know, very often the time sort of runs away from you as the week goes on, especially if, you know, you've got a job or you're looking after children. And it's quite nice to feel that you've kind of got ahead of yourself by getting, you know, 1,000 words or something down on a Monday night. So I think hopefully people go away with quite a good feeling. I think people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you give people the gift of time on a Monday evening when they feel like they need to pick me up for their week. Is definitely an amazing way to start the week. Now, you say that you have guest authors. What, you know, can you tell me a bit about who you've had in the past and who you might be having in the new year?
Yeah, well, I mean, the great thing about being, you know, based in Brighton and Hove is that there's just so many writers. So I'm kind of, you know, spoilt for choice, really. The very first writer we had was Kate Harrison, who is actually somebody I knew from way back when I worked at the BBC a long time ago. And since then, she has written, she's written books in many different genres, fiction novels in many different genres. She's also written non-fiction. So she was a great guest because she could cover lots of different areas of the industry. You know, our members of the Hove Writers Group are quite diverse in the sense of what they're writing. So, you know, she was great. We've also had the crime writer William Shaw came in to speak to us. Frances Quinn, who's a historical fiction writer. Dr. Beth Miller was really fascinating. She writes women's fiction, but she's also a tutor and a coach. So she did a great session. I think people really learned, you know, a lot from her, not just about writing, but about other, you know, about their motivation and things like that. And who else have we had? Oh, Nicola Wilson is a screenwriter. She's quite recently written an episode of Call the Midwife on the TV. So she was great. She had a completely different perspective again and was talking about writing for stage and screen. But like I say, I'm very lucky to be here.
Absolutely. And I guess this time of year, everyone's got their New Year's resolutions. Everyone's looking to do something new. What aspects of the group do you think will really appeal to people looking to take up writing in the new year?
Well, I think everyone sort of starts with good intentions, don't they? And it's so easy for them to slip. And I think that's one of the things that I really hope that we can do. Is kind of hold each other accountable. I think if you make it a part of your regular schedule, then it's you know, it's something that's more likely to happen, that the work will actually get done. So that's why I like this idea that every Monday night you kind of get out of your house, you get away from all the other demands on you and your time, and you go to this place and you know you're going to get that 2 hours of actual writing time. And we do sort of cheer each other on a little bit. You know, there's an element of kind of cheerleading in the group, I think. When we sort of, at 8 o'clock, when people go and sit down to write, sometimes, not every week, but sometimes I will literally say, like, what's your goal? You know, what's your goal for the next 2 hours? Have you got a word count in mind, or is there a particular bit of your work that you're kind of planning, you know, what to, you know, to try and sort of focus people on what they're doing. And then I hope as well we do sort of feedback sessions. So if people do need a little bit of support, they need some eyes over their work, if they're a bit unsure of, you know, they've written something, they're not quite sure, then they can kind of share it with quite a small group, which is quite a nice sympathetic group, in the sense that, like I say, we're just supporting each other. I don't really like using the word critique because it's too close to criticism.
Yeah.
And I don't really, you know, I really want the atmosphere, the ethos of the group to be very inclusive, very non-judgmental, very supportive, because I think it's quite vulnerable, isn't it, when you first start sharing your work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I definitely want people to feel confident in doing that. I want the atmosphere almost to be quite sort of playful, you know, so people feel that they can just kind of try things out and experiment with things and you know, and then share it with the group and see how it lands. And so I think that's another thing that can be really useful for people, you know, and actually to keep your motivation up, to keep you going towards your new resolutions, as if you've actually got sort of deadlines. So once a month, for example, we will have a feedback session, and that's just like a little mini deadline that people can work towards. I used to be a journalist, so I'm a very deadline driven person, and I think other people are maybe as well. So, you know, hopefully that's helpful to people too.
Absolutely. So it definitely sounds like it's holding people accountable in a way that a friend does, as opposed to a hardline editor does, in that you have the supportive space to do things and creative freedom while having a really well-knit support group. I definitely want to hear more about you as a writer. So what about you? What about Brighton inspires you?
It's been great to move to Brighton. It's been so nice to have just so many other writers around. I think, like pretty much every writer, I do struggle sometimes with the, you know, the isolation side of it. And so it's just, it's just fantastic to be around other writers, to sort of go on the odd little kind of walk along the seafront and, you know, with other people who kind of get it. It's really nice to be with people who are writing in all different genres and all different parts of the industry. I'm always inspired by a new place as well. I tend to get quite inspired by settings. So I've, since I arrived here sort of 2 years ago, I've actually written a whole novel now set here, because every time I move, I then have to write a novel wherever I move to. Yeah. I've been an expat for a long time, so I've moved around quite a lot, and I find it's a bit of a habit. I write something wherever I move to. And just, I don't know, but yeah, it's just, there's just a great atmosphere here of things happening, and I think you can sort of feed off that energy a little bit. I used to live in Singapore, and that's a similar kind of thing. It's like a really thriving, buzzing place, and that kind of, that was when I wrote my first novel that actually got published, and it was, and I did have a real sense that I was feeding off the energy of the place and kind of, you know, directing that into my writing. And I feel it a little bit here as well. There's kind of something in the air, and everyone seems to have, you know, everyone seems to just be very creative here. And yeah, I just feel like I've plugged into it.
Absolutely. And so for anyone looking to perhaps do something they've always wanted to do with writing, or to start to have a New Year's resolution, where can we find more about Hove Writers and how can we be involved?
Okay, well, we meet every Monday night in a pub called The Wick, which is on Western Road. It's actually sort of Palmyra Square. We meet in the Speakeasy Bar, which is upstairs in The Wick, which is great because it's a kind of private space. So we have a bit of peace and quiet up there. But the best thing to do really is to contact me via the website. So if you just Google Hove Creative Writing Group, you will come to my little website, and there's a contact page on there, kind of all the details are on there of kind of how it runs. And you can just drop me an email and take it from there.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Jo. It's been an absolute pleasure. And as someone who has been to your sessions, I can absolutely endorse it as a fantastic way to get out, meet new people, be in a really supportive environment, and generally feel very inspired with that creative Brighton energy that we have around us. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Now, you may remember from September's show, where Laura Mugridge and I discussed the Women's Prize shortlist, that Laura's favourite book was Unsettled Ground, and it really made me want to read it. I love Claire Fuller's writing, and I especially loved her first book, Our Endless Numbered Days. So since being shortlisted for the Women's Prize and sadly not winning, it has been longlisted for the Costa Book of the Year, which is really exciting. So what I'm going to do is read from the blurb, talk about why we love the book so much, and then invite Claire on to talk about it. Twins Jeannie and Julius have always been different from other people. At 51 years old, they still live with their mother, Dot, in rural isolation and poverty. Inside the walls of their old cottage, they make music, and in the garden they grow, and sometimes kill, everything they need for sustenance. But when Dot dies suddenly, threats to their livelihood start raining down. Jeannie and Julius would do anything to preserve their small sanctuary against the perils of the outside world, even as their mother's secrets begin to unravel, putting everything they thought they knew about their lives at stake. Unsettled Ground is a heart-stopping novel of betrayal and resilience, love and survival. It is a portrait of life on the fringes of society that explores with dazzling emotional power how we can build our lives on broken foundations and spin light from darkness. So Unsettled Ground was certainly unsettling. It's such a beautifully drawn book, and you really go along with these characters whose whole lives, right from the beginning of the book, have been turned completely upside down by the sudden death of their mother. The rural setting is so sensory, you can almost smell the mud and feel it under your fingernails. It's a thought-provoking and tender book that explores displacement and isolation, and it's a really interesting exploration of codependence with protagonists who are older than we may expect them to be. So I'm absolutely honoured to be joined by Claire Fuller to talk about this book. Welcome, Claire, to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, well, I'm Claire Fuller, the author of Unsettled Ground and three previous novels, as you said, Erin Lisnumber Day, Swimming Lessons and Bitter Orange.
I'm just going to ask you, which is something I really like to do with authors who have written more than a couple of books, is can you sum them all up in a sentence or two? So if we start with Our Endless Number Days.
Our Endless Number Days is about Peggy, who in 1976 is taken to a remote European forest by her father, and they remain there for 9 years until she makes it home.
Swimming Lessons.
Swimming Lessons is about a woman called Ingrid who writes letters to her husband about the state of their marriage, but rather than giving them to him, she hides them in the books that he collects, and then she disappears off a Dorset beach.
And how about Bitter Orange?
This is hard. Bitter Orange is about a woman called Frances who goes to survey the gardens of an English country house in 1969 and meets there a couple who are very bohemian, and she kind of falls in love with them, and she also spies on them through a hole in her bathroom floor.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so exciting. So the main characters, Claire, in Unsettled Ground are 51. Why did you decide to make your protagonists this age?
Well, they are the age that I was when I started writing, which it's not a terribly good reason, but it does kind of help when you're starting out on a novel to, you know, put yourself in the mind of one of the characters, so that helps. But I had always intended to write older characters, and in fact when I started Bitter Orange, Frances, who I think she's something like 39 in the novel, in the main part of the novel, although she's 20 years old and looking back, I wanted to make her much, much older. And then for various reasons, she just kept getting younger and younger and younger. And so I thought, well, with Unsettled Ground, I'll try and make these characters older, because I feel there aren't really enough older characters in fiction.
Absolutely. There's lots in your books, Claire, about the lies that our parents tell us, and especially the lies that come out after they die or disappear. Why is this something that recurs in your books?
Yeah, I know that it does, but I have no idea. My parents are both alive, and as far as I'm aware, they haven't told me any major lies. So it's not like I'm kind of exploring something that I have to get out. But I don't know. I suppose lies and secrets and death, you know, they all help a narrative flow, and, you know, those kinds of secrets will keep a reader reading. They're just great fodder for stories.
Absolutely. And on that note, please, can you read us some?
Yeah, I'm going to read right from the beginning, just a little bit. The morning sky lightens and snow falls on the cottage. It falls on the thatch, concealing the moss and the mouse damage, smoothing out the undulations, filling in the hollows and slips, melting where it touches the bricks of the chimney. It settles on the plants and bare soil in the front garden and forms a perfect mound on top of the rotten gatepost, as though shaped from the inside of a teacup. It hides the roof of the chicken coop and those of the privy and the old dairy, leaving a dusting across the workbench and floor where the window was broken long ago. In the vegetable garden at the back, The snow slides through the rips in the plastic of the polytunnel, chills the onion sets 4 inches underground, and shrivels the new shoots of the Swiss chard. Only the head of the last winter cabbage refuses to succumb, the interior leaves curled green and strong, waiting. In the high double bed up the left staircase, Dot lies beside her adult daughter Jeannie, who is gently snoring. Something different about the light in the room has woken Dot, and she can't get back to sleep. She gets out of the bed, floorboards cold, air colder, and puts on her dressing gown and slippers. The dog, Jeannie's dog, a biscuit-coloured lurcher who sleeps on the landing with her back to the chimney breast, raises her head, inquiring about the early hour as Dot passes, luring it when she gets no answer. I'll leave it there.
Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, it's such a vivid opening to a book. So the reception from Unsettled Ground has been wonderful, Claire, with a lot of people describing it as your best work yet and comparing you to a modern day Daphne du Maurier, which you must be delighted about. How have you felt seeing this book come to such critical acclaim?
Oh, it's been wonderful. It's not something I would ever expect. You know, I write the next book. I hope that that people connect with it. I hope that it reaches a lot of readers. You know, I don't expect much more than that. And so when things start to happen, you know, when it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize and shortlisted for the Costa Novel Award, it's absolutely delightful, of course. And knowing that those things will help it reach a wider audience.
So our theme for this show is new beginnings, and it's very appropriate, although not planned, that you didn't start writing fiction until your 40s. So you kind of had this new beginning. What were you doing before, and what made you decide to change career?
Well, I studied sculpture as my first degree many years ago in the 1980s, and then I ended up working in a marketing company, or running a small marketing agency in Winchester in Hampshire. And I've always been a reader, a big, big reader, but I never intended to be a writer. It was just not something on my agenda at all. And then when I was 40, I had been doing some kind of public art projects, because although I'd been working in marketing, I had carried on doing some art. And they were really out of my comfort zone because they were public. But I liked having done them. I didn't like the doing. I liked the feeling when I had actually done something that had been difficult. And I was looking for more of that feeling. And I came across in my local library what they called a short story slam. Anybody could sign up for it. You had to write a short story that lasted 5 minutes when you read it out to a paying audience. And I had not written any creative writing at all, or not since I was 16 at school. And so I wrote a story and I read it out, and it was very bad. But I carried on doing it. The event happened every 6 weeks or so, and I carried on and I carried on, and I wrote lots of short stories. And then I decided to do an MA in creative writing, and I wrote our Endless Number Days on that course.
Our Endless Number Days was one of the best books I read. That was it 2015 or 16?
15, yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's such a long time ago. I do love it. I still think about it a lot. Let's talk a bit about your journey to publication, Claire. Was it straightforward, or was it more winding?
Well, I'm very lucky in that it was very straightforward, because I know that doesn't normally happen. Having done my MA, I did learn about the publishing process, and that you need to get a literary agent first if you want to be traditionally published. And so I went through all that process. You know, I didn't know anyone in publishing. I didn't know anyone who had written a book before. I sent my manuscript out to about 14 agents, and I got a couple of rejections, but I got one agent who was very interested, and she loved the book, and I met with her in London, and she offered to represent me, and we did some edits, and then she sent it out to a number of editors in publishing houses, and I couldn't quite believe it, but because we had three offers, which meant the book then went to auction. And in the end, Penguin won. it was just so amazing. I really hadn't anticipated that at all.
And you've been writing for Penguin ever since, haven't you?
Yes, Penguin are my UK publisher. They only buy one book at a time, which means I have to write a book, finish it completely, send it to them and hope that they will buy it. Luckily so far, they have bought all the books that I've written. But I have other, you know, publishers, different publishers in America and Canada and other countries.
Are you working on another book at the moment?
I am. I have just finished what I call the first draft of my next book, but the first draft is actually, you know, relatively fairly finished, really. I've got some edits to do. And that's taken me 2 years. And yeah, I'm really nearly reaching the end of it. So it, hopefully maybe in January or early next year, it will go to Penguin and we'll see what they say.
Is there anything you can exclusively tell us about it?
I can tell you a little bit, in that it, I started it in about October 2019, so before the pandemic, before we even had any idea that a pandemic was around the corner. And I was thinking, what would I like to write? And I decided that I would like to write a pandemic novel.
Really?
Yes. And so I was writing this, I can't remember, I was maybe 20,000-30,000 words in when the pandemic actually started to happen. And it did kind of pull me up short. Should I carry on with this book? Should I stop? And I have actually carried on. So it is a pandemic novel, which takes a very different route to ours, to the one that is actually still happening. But it's, although a pandemic is, a very serious pandemic is happening, it's more about five people who sign up for a clinical drug trial and remain in the unit when the pandemic is happening on the outside.
That sounds amazing. I'm so excited. So finally, Claire, what advice would you give to any aspiring writers, especially ones who are 40 plus?
Oh, I don't think the age matters particularly. Or maybe when you're 40 plus, you should feel that you can do anything. You can change anything. You can take more risks maybe than when you're younger. And you know, I think you get to a certain age where you think, oh, I'm just going to do it. So try and have that attitude. But also, I think what a lot of aspiring writers struggle with is finishing. You know, it's quite easy to have the idea that fires you up and you start writing and you get to about 30 or 40,000 words and it becomes a slog. And it is hard work. And I still find that with every book, you just have to push through that to the end. And only when you get to the end do you realise kind of what you've got and that you can edit it and make it into something good.
Thank you so much for joining us, Claire. How can we follow you and buy a copy of your wonderful books?
Well, I'm on Instagram at writer Claire Fuller. So it'd be lovely if people came and said hello there. I'm also on Twitter and I'm Claire Fuller 2, the number 2 there. So do come and say hello. And then, yeah, the book is available from all bookshops. I also online and independents. I do like to try and support independents or bricks and mortar bookshops. So, you know, great if you can get your books from there, but wherever.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you for listening. Our next book club book is Peach Blossom Spring by Melissa Fu, a bold and moving look at the history of modern China. It is told through the story of one family and spans from 1938 to 2005 in China, Taiwan, and the USA. It's an epic, powerful, and intensely personal debut about war, migration, family, and the search for a place to belong. After a short break, we'll be back with a new show on February the 27th. Do get in touch with your ideas for the show at btnbookclub@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram at btnbookclub. If you're a business in Brighton who'd like a boost, email us to find out about affordable sponsorship opportunities. Thank you for listening, keep reading, and we'll see you in a few weeks.